Once upon a time, there was no such thing as hospice or palliative care, and those facing serious illness or even death dealt with it very differently than they do today. Dying with dignity wasn't always the way it was done. Today, a conversation with two veterans in the hospice and palliative care field who are retiring after years of service. They'll talk to us about the changes in attitudes and treatments that they've seen over those years. With us today, Elaine McIntosh is the outgoing president and CEO at Kansas City Hospice and Palliative Care. For the past 24 years, she's held that position. She's staying on until a successor is found. Elaine, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
Dr. Anna Legray is the recently retired director of medical programs for Kansas City Hospice and Palliative Care. And nice to have you too. Welcome.
Great to be here, Steve.
Elaine, are things really that different from when you first started out?
That's a great
really
question.
Changed? Yeah.
Things have really changed, and some things have really not changed and are very much the same.
What's changed?
The things that have changed, I think, is the general level of acceptance of hospice services, the broadening of the hospice approach to patient care in the palliative care realm, the notion that this is a important time, a sacred time, a time when both the patient and the family need and certainly deserve a very high level of support. So I think the general level of acceptance of hospice care has changed enormously. Hmm. I think that previous to hospice, the vast majority of people died in the hospital. Hospice has made death at home acceptable and possible for those who choose that. I think a second contribution that has come from hospice is elevating the problem of pain and suffering mm-hmm. in advanced disease. It was really the hospice movement that articulated the urgency of doing a better job of treating people's suffering and dispelled some of the notions around addiction at the end, you know, to heavy duty drugs at the end of life, et cetera. So I think those are a couple of things that the opportunity to have death occur at home, surrounded by loved ones in familiar surroundings, and the elevation of attention to suffering.
And when did this change take place? 60s, 70s? And I'm wondering if that's the case, why? What was going on in society that caused us to switch gears when it came to this very important topic of dying with dignity?
Sure. I think there are a lot of things that went on in society, and I was young and probably not too attentive to everything that was happening, but this was a time when we were shifting from the doctor is God and just follow his instructions to more of a patient's rights perspective, mm-hmm. more autonomy for patients, along with women's rights and civil rights and other things that were arising.
So it came along with that whole wave of stuff that was happening in the late 60s.
I think that was, at that time, that was one of the important things. And then we began to, as technology was ever more and more applied, we began to have questions about when does it stop? Mm-hmm. And the Karen Ann Quinlan case in the 70s was one of those, can we stop a ventilator for someone who has severe brain impairment? And that was really the first legal case that helped to establish what are the principles that we can work under.
Yeah.
But I did medical school in the late 70s, and there was no mention of hospice. Hospice was not yet a Medicare benefit until 1982, and so it was still way off the radar.
Yeah, I'm wondering, as the two of you either have exited the stage, in your case, Anne or Elaine, you're getting close to retirement here, is end-of-life care, palliative care, where it should be now, or is there still a ways to go?
There's a long ways to go.
Really?
We've come a long ways, but there is still a long way to go.
Like, where do we have to be?
I think that, let me start with the physician community. There still is, I think, a reluctance on the part of many physicians to really discuss the potential outcomes directly with patients and families. I think that
surprises me. I thought we were in a different place now.
Well, I think some physicians are there, but many are not. Mm-hmm. And we have to still remember that physicians are not trained to have these kinds of conversations, which are time intense And physicians and most parts of the healthcare system operate in quite a pressure cooker these days to keep moving. And so the sit-down and slow-down conversation that really is essential for families to ground themselves in where they are in the course of illness is a challenging thing.
Even if you're talking about patients who are on close to death, the most pivotal moment perhaps it obviously is in their lives.
Most people, people are different. Some people come to this with great equanimity and mm-hmm. they understand that's where they are. And even many people who are very close to the end of their lives are not there. It takes a skilled hand to really surface this conversation and help pull people through the thinking about how do you want this time in your life to go? What's important to you now?
And do you share this view that we're not quite where we need to be?
Oh, certainly. We have made a lot of progress, especially since the 90s. And I could list a lot of ways in which things are better. But there's still this reluctance and this lack of attention to these types of conversations. You may know that Medicare recently approved payment to physicians for having end-of-life conversations with their patients. Before that, it was not considered a billable service. Huh. But a recent survey said that 80% of practicing physicians don't feel competent or trained to have those conversations.
And how does that change then? What do we need to do on that front?
Well, there's been a lot of effort to increase education, and the new medical graduates now, the ones that are going through medical school and residency now, do get training in it. The problem is us old timers who are already out there in practice who didn't get the training, and how do we get the support? And then, as Elaine said, they're under tremendous time pressure, and it seems like this is going to take too much time. And we also have an extremely fragmented healthcare system, so that, you know, when I started out, you had a primary doctor, saw you at the office, saw you in the hospital, kind of was the captain of the ship and mm-hmm. brought everything together. And now we have hospitalists when you're in the hospital. We have subspecialists, each taking care of their organ, but who's taking care of the patient and helping patients and families understand how everything fits together.
You know, we're sitting here, Elaine, talking about these words, you know, hospice and that big word, palliative care. What do they mean?
They really are very, very similar. They both describe a particular approach to care. Mm-hmm. And that approach to care is based on whole person care, understanding that when you have a serious diagnosis or a life-threatening condition, it's not just about what's happening to you medically. It's emotional, it's social, it's spiritual, it's existential. And hospice and palliative care embrace the whole person and the whole family. It embodies expertise in terms of pain and symptom management. It embodies expertise in terms of the practical side of what's happening, setting up your house, getting you home from the hospital, et cetera. But the real difference is who receives it. Hospice care is provided by and large to people who are in a comfort-only mode. That's where they are. That's made. That's the decision. And
you can't cure them of whatever ails.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And by and large, they have a prognosis of 6 months or less if the disease follows its normal course. Mm-hmm. Palliative care is the same services, but the people who receive it maybe just received a diagnosis, just had a stroke, are in the ICU, and they're needing to see a palliative care physician. So it is more about who receives it than there being a difference in terms of the type of services that are provided.
You know, you guys sent us some interesting misconceptions about hospice and palliative care. The Kansas City Hospice and Palliative Care folks did this before the show. Here's one, and that hospice just lasts for a few days. Why is that a misconception?
It's a misconception that if you go to hospice, you will die sooner, and that it's only intended for the last few days of life.
Yes.
We're now reaching twice as many Medicare recipients as we did 20 years ago. Now, in the about 45% of people who die who will receive hospice near the end of life, but still about half of them it's less than 2 weeks. And it sort of gets into a self-fulfilling prophecy. Don't go to hospice until you're almost dead. And then once you get to hospice, you're going to die quickly.
So you can go to hospice sooner.
Yes. The Medicare benefit actually originally was set up to provide hospice services in the last 6 months of life. And patients can live longer than that as long as they are gradually progressing in through their decline.
Here's another one, Elaine. A hospice over-medicates patients and hastens death.
There is a misconception that hospice gives too much medication. And I want to say very clearly that hospice gives as much medication as we believe is going to control the patient's discomfort and not one drop more. But it is true that sometimes if people have been in pain for a period of time and it has gone unaddressed and they become comfortable because adequate medication has been given so they can relax, possibly get some sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it appears as though the patient has been over-medicated because they've been awake and suffering, and now they're sleeping and not rousable. But it is a myth, and I think a solid hospice program with expertise such as Dr. Allegri and other physicians on staff really know how to manage and dose those medications.
And yet another misconception, all hospices are alike.
I think Elaine should address that question.
All hospices are definitely not alike. There are... This is a serious medical problem, and it is necessary that people have serious medical professionals on staff. And I would just say that there has been a proliferation of hospice, really, in the state of Missouri and Kansas and in many parts of the country. And... there are very major differences.
Mm-hmm.
Consumer Reports did an article last December, I think, of 2014, which made a series of recommendations in terms of how to choose a hospice. And some of the things that they identify are, does the hospice have hospice and palliative medicine board certified physicians on the staff? Does the hospice provide services across the entire continuum of care in the home, as well as having an inpatient option and opportunity that the hospice manages? Is the hospice 20, they identified a 20 years of service marker, and they also identified the not-for-profit hospices as one of the criteria that they recommend people look at as they are choosing hospice.
So 20 years of service would suggest a business that is doing things the right way.
A long-standing operation,
yeah.
Yes.
You know, I'm wondering, we were talking a little bit ago, Anne, about why things changed in this whole field of hospice and palliative care. And, you know, my generation often thinks of a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote this seminal book on death and dying, I think the book was. What was her contribution? How important was she?
She is certainly very important. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was one of the first to really talk to people who were dying and to report what their experience was like. And so when that was published in 1969, that certainly advanced the conversation about what are the deficits. There were other factors that came in the 1990s, mid-90s, the Soros Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation poured millions of dollars into efforts to improve end-of-life care. And in 1995, there was a huge study of almost 10,000 patients who were seriously ill or dying, looking at their experience. And they were still having terrible experiences in terms of the needs of those who were approaching death.
Hmm.
So that spurred even more development. How can we do a better job? I think
Kubler-Ross sort of got the ball rolling.
She did, got the conversation rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And Cicely Saunders was a woman who had been a nurse, then social worker, and eventually physician who was in London, who founded the modern hospice movement in the late 60s. And then that model was brought to the U.S. in the 70s.
Let me go to some phone calls here. If you want to join our conversation about hospice, end-of-life care, what experience of a loved one was, would be interested in hearing about it. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Kurt from the east side of Kansas City. Kurt, good morning.
Yeah, I was wondering if in the future there's any time when the director of the hospice program, the doctor, would see all the patients rather than just sending a group of nurses out.
I think that's a great question, Kirk. One of the challenges right now is that hospice and palliative medicine is a new subspecialty and a rapidly growing field, so there aren't enough bodies to meet all the needs.
And you would think with the baby boomer generation getting where it is, the demand is only going to keep shooting upwards.
The demand is shooting up dramatically, but there's now a bottleneck in how many training slots there are in the country. So, and you know, those of us who were the pioneers in the field, if you were, are nearing retirement. And so, you know, we're going to need replacement. So it's very rare that a hospice has enough support from physicians or even nurse practitioners who are trained in this field that they can see all the patients at home. And then the other problem is the short length of stay. If a patient's only on service for 3 days, it's hard to schedule and get out to see all those patients.
Does that help, Kurt?
Well, in my experience, I was there for my parents' death, and I got our family around. My mother had long-term illness, but I was negotiating between my parents' doctors, who did not seem to be very informed about medicine in general, quite frankly. I just thought that if I'd been able to get another opinion from a hospice doctor, who would be hopefully much more enlightened. But as it was, it just turned out the nurses showed up and she was out of it, and there was no need for that. If she'd got a proper medical diagnosis, she could have just needed episodic pain care. But when they showed up, they, you know, didn't want to listen to me. She was out, and she just comfortably starved and died of thirst. And there was a good hospice death, don't get me wrong, but there just should have been some checks and balances, or, you know, could have been handled better. Thank you.
Yeah, Kurt, thank you, and sorry about your tough experience. Ann, any other thoughts on that?
I think that's the problems that he had are exactly one of the roles that the hospice medical director should be fulfilling, and that is if there's a conflict, or if the patient's attending physician is not comfortable with symptom management, then the hospice medical director should be available at least by phone consultation with that doctor or with the nurses to help find the best treatment for that patient.
Yeah, is one of the issues here, Elaine, that does hospice cost a lot of money? You're talking about individualized care. You're talking about slowing down. And in a medical field today that, as you were saying earlier, the pressure is just to go faster all the time.
Well, in regard to whether hospice costs a lot of money, in relative terms, absolutely not. Because what happens to an individual when they don't have hospice oftentimes is a series of hospitalizations, emergency rooms, et cetera. So there is a tremendous cost offset when a hospice team has gotten involved, especially early enough in the course of care,
right,
to be able to prevent crises. By and large, most people do not have out-of-pocket related expenses associated with hospice, especially under the Medicare program. It is a very comprehensive package of coverage under Medicare and under some, probably most, commercial insurance hospice benefits. The labor is covered, their medications are covered, their oxygen or hospital bed is covered, medical supplies, etc. Hospice is actually one of the most organized parts of the healthcare system that there is, because it is required that there be a interdisciplinary team. It is required that a certain array of services and supplies be covered and coordinated. So that's one of the best kept secrets. This thing is organized, unlike many other parts of the system, which are very fragmented, and the various providers are not in close communication with one another.